Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 15th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Revisiting Chaos, Revisioning Creation, Ponder Anew. Presented by Gene Larson, session number LAJ 2005-04. Let's listen in.
Much more akin to my way of thinking. I mean, I think in stories, I'm not a scientist. This stuff is really a stretch for me. But this story, I think, is really helpful, to me at least, because you'll see why. I'll just do it. As a way of getting us thinking about how big God is and how we often don't get it. This is God from God in the Doorway, teaching a stone to talk. And I'll just read excerpts from it and summarize some parts of it. This is an autobiographical little story, a memory of her childhood. Christmas Eve, she's up very late with her family, and I'll take it from there. I had taken off my fancy winter coat and was standing on the heat register to bake my shoes, my shoe soles and warm my bare legs. There was a commotion at the front door. It opened, and cold wind blew around my dress. Everyone was calling me, "Look who's here! Look who's here!" I looked. It was Santa Claus, whom I never, ever wanted to meet. Santa Claus was looming in the doorway and looking around for me. My mother's voice was thrilled, "Look who's here!" I ran upstairs. Like everyone in his right mind, I feared Santa Claus, thinking he was God. I was still thoughtless and brute, reactive. I knew right from wrong, but had barely tested the possibility of shaping my own behavior. And then only from fear, and not yet from love. Santa Claus was an old man whom you never saw, but who nevertheless saw you. He knew when you'd been bad or good. He knew when you were bad or good, and I'd been bad. So she goes on to say that she never did come down. She hides that night and never did encounter Santa Claus. But then learned later that Santa Claus really was the old lady across the street, Miss White, who had taught her about nature and continued to. And Annie Dillard liked her, Miss White. Miss White meant no harm on earth. And yet half a year after her failed visit as Santa Claus, I ran from her again. That day, a day of the following summer, Miss White and I knelt in her yard while she showed me a magnifying glass. It was a large, strong hand lens. She lifted my hand and, holding it very still, focused a dab of sunshine on my palm. The glowing crescent wobbled, spread, and finally contracted to a point. It burned. I was burned. I ripped my hand away and ran home crying. Miss White called after me, sorry, explaining, but I didn't look back. Even now I wonder, if I meet God, will he take and hold my bare hand in his and focus his eye on my palm and kindle that spot and let me burn? But no, it is I who misunderstood everything and let everybody down. Miss White, God, I'm sorry I ran from you. I'm still running, running from that knowledge, that I, that love from which there is no refuge. For you meant only love and love, and I felt only fear and pain. So once in Israel, love came to us incarnate, stood in the doorway between two worlds, and we were all afraid. Welcome, you guys. That was a little story from Annie Dillard. Let's pray. Oh, big God, help us not to be afraid. Help us to live in your huge creation, not in fear, but in love. Through Jesus Christ, our brother and Lord. I'm in. All right. Welcome, you guys. I've mentioned that today is the day we're going to do some heavy theological lifting. And so for all of us, including me, I mean, this is heavy theological lifting for me too. I hope that it goes okay, and I hope that by the end of this, we sort of get it. But there's the danger of us just being totally confused, and so I don't know which way it's going to go. I would really love your feedback, however. This is my trial run with this material, and you're my guinea pigs. And I would really, in all seriousness, benefit from your feedback. And if it's really challenging and you don't want to give it in person, you can write me a note. So, thanks for coming. All week long we've been talking about wildfire as a case study of chaos in creation. We've learned that wildfire, while it used to have this understanding of being the enemy and had to be fought all the time and suppressed, we've reviewed what we've learned for some time, that wildfire, in fact, is essential to the health of the forest, that through the fire process itself, it gives new life to all sorts of beautiful, wondrous trees and plants and ecosystems. Theologically, we've looked at creation. We've looked at Genesis 1 in particular, and looked at the very beginning, in the beginning, when God was creating the heavens and the earth. The earth was a formless void. We've used this fun word, tohu. This is the Hebrew, tohu vabohu. Actually, those are three words, but it's sort of fun to squish them together. Formless and void, waste schmace. This is the chaos stuff that existed at the beginning of creation. So we've been talking about chaos, tohu vabohu. We've made poor little Emma here the chaos monster. In the Bible, chaos was often personified as a monster, often called Leviathan, but also the deep, the waters, the sea, all this good stuff.
You switched.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's what you mean.
I kept saying,
where is everyone? Oh, sorry, John. Well, you could bring anybody else over there with you, but you were the faithful person. So that's what we've been doing all week. And we've set up this idea of a change in paradigm. Okay, the biological forest science paradigm has already changed from fire's bad to fire's good. Okay, now we're asking about the theological paradigm. Can we move on that and have this theological paradigm switch from chaos bad to chaos good, maybe? Helpful? Built in? That's the question we're going to look at today. So, this is sort of this equation I put together. Wildfire is to the forest as chaos is to creation. Of course, in the old paradigm, this was wildfire bad, forest good, chaos bad, creation good. But, you know, can we do this? That's the question today. So, here we go. I put actually a sort of an outline to help me and to help you, because that's just the way it is. It's just sort of a big deal. It's sort of complicated. So let's start. Calling a truce in the war against chaos. That's where we're going to start. I'm proposing a theological paradigm that says that chaos is not evil. And that chaos is not opposed to creation, which in my theological training was always how it was done. That creation happens when chaos is put in its boundaries. I'm saying, no, that's really, although there's certainly scriptural stuff with it, that I don't want to make that an absolute. And we'll look at some scriptural stuff, too, that might open that up a little bit. We've sort of already done that. So that's what I want to do, and I want to remind us of this lovely thing in Genesis 1. That might lead us there. And here, I don't read the Bible at all literally, and it's just very suggestive, very metaphorical, especially in Genesis 1. Listen to how, once again, the Leviathan is spoken of in Genesis 1. And God said, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky. So God created the great sea monsters, and every living creature that moves of every kind with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day. This is an amazing little piece. Not just because God says that God created the sea monsters and they were good, but God gives the sea monsters this order that God gives only to human beings. Doesn't give it to any other creatures. Be fruitful and multiply. And the verb used here, when God created the sea monsters and all the other creatures, is unique. It's used only of humans. The other creation word used in Genesis is different. It's used of everything else. So, this is really odd. I'll just lay that out there. We won't go any further with that. Okay, so here's how we're going to get there. The war is over. Chaos is. The war on chaos has failed. We can't control chaos. We've learned that with the forests. Our attempts to control wildfire not only have failed, I mean, all the huge wildfires are eventually put out by rain and snow, not by human agency. But our attempt to control it has backfired, so that our attempt to control it has made it worse. Suppression of wildfire has made catastrophic wildfire more likely because of the buildup of fuel. So call off the war. We can't control chaos, and God hasn't defeated it. This is sort of a startling proposition. But the other day when we were looking at the biblical stuff, we saw that there were sort of two trajectories in the Bible about God's relationship to chaos. One was this old trajectory that's related to this Babylonian creation myth, in which God absolutely defeats chaos. In the old myth, chaos was cut in half, and half of her became the earth, and half of her became the heavens. And some of that we find in the Psalms and Isaiah. God has not defeated chaos simply by human experience. We experience that all the time. And then the question is, does God always master or tame it? That's the other trajectory in the Bible, that God is keeping chaos in its boundaries, and we see that in Genesis 1 and all over the place, Psalm 104. And maybe we can say, yeah, God often tames it or masters it, but chaos pops out with some regularity. And so God isn't totally on top of this thing. This is puzzling, and it's a problem, and it's the problem behind all of our question about why we suffer. I want to start going in a new direction that's very tentative. Every time chaos breaks out, we get hurt and confused, and we ask God why. Or we shake our fists at the heavens, and that's okay. But I'm beginning to wonder if we do this because we're starting at the wrong place, theologically. If we're starting with the wrong set of assumptions about human life and God and creation. Now it seems to me that what is normal is that God's creation is orderly, that it was intended to be orderly and predictable, and that when chaos happens, that's abnormal and that's sort of evil. And, you know, that's not the expected state of affairs. But with this new understanding of chaos, I'm wondering if what is normal is really chaos. What is normal is really unpredictable life. I know, that's my suggestion. I mean, the chaos monster is good. Why? What does chaos do in creation that's good? Is it built in to creation? That's where chaos theory sort of goes. But hang on, we'll get there. Okay, so the war is over. Chaos is. Theology has to learn from science here. We've always learned from science. Copernicus, you know, the whole revolution when Copernicus figured out that the sun really is the center of our little galaxy, not the earth. And that was hard. That was a huge revolution theologically in the church. It was hard for people to take. What, isn't the earth the center of God's creation, and isn't humanity the center of the earth? And so this is, with Copernicus, we've started this process of decentering what we formerly thought was the heart and soul of creation. We're still arguing over Darwin. I want to say that theology has to learn from science, not that science dictates faith. And certainly it's not the object of faith. And science, real science, is always tentative. It's always trying to find actual facts on the ground and observable things that we can learn new things from. But I want to say that science does give us relatively trustworthy data for faith. And really, we're simply asking, what does our Father's world really look like? How does it really operate? Inquiring minds need to know, and inquiring faith needs to know. So, there you go. So as wildfire has demonstrated proven scientific positive role in creation and bringing forth new life, might chaos more generally be seen to have a positive role in creation? And then the further question is, that we probably won't get to today, but we might tomorrow, is so what? Does it make any difference for our faith and how we live our lives? Okay, so the new paradigm requires us to be honest about chaos. And the first thing we need to do is grieve. That's a B. It's a really bad B. We need to grieve. David Strohmeyer is a fascinating guy. He lives in Missoula. He's trained theologically. He went to Yale Divinity School. And he's trained as a forester. And he's a terrific writer. He's come out with this book that's in the bookstore, Seasons of Fire. And he's coming out with a new book called Drift Smoke. And it's all about loss in wildfire. And he says we need to be serious about this and take it, be human about wildfire. He says that he criticizes the ecological Pollyannas, environmental activists, land managers, academicians, quoting here, who have become incrementally jaded to loss. You know, they, and I've subjected this too, get so excited about this new life that we see coming out of the ashes. Yesterday we saw these cool pictures of the Bitterroot National Forest ashes, you know, within 1 week after the fire, just plunk. And then 5 years later, this incredible beauty of green, pink fireweed and new life. And, it, you know, you sort of go towards the new life, and it's easy to forget the suffering. And Strohmeyer is saying, don't. He says, taking a long-term perspective, Aldo Leopold called it thinking like a mountain, may be ecologically and aesthetically desirable, but it's existentially difficult for human beings to do that. And he just says we need to grieve. That's probably obvious to us in the wake of Katrina. Maybe 10,000 victims. The tsunami, 150,000 people died. Wildfire, when you look at tragedies, they're much smaller scale. I mean, you see the tragedy of Man Gulch, 1949, 13 people dead. If you've not read Young Men in Fire yet by Norman McLean, you've got to read that book. It's a gorgeous book. It's a tragedy. It's a gorgeous book about this Man Gulch fire in Montana. The Storm King fire, 1994, 14 dead. The big blow-up of 1910, 78 dead. Wildfire kills people and destroys beloved landscapes and sometimes destroys beloved structures. And we need to grieve. We need to be honest about that. We need to confess our sin. It's the second move here in being honest about chaos. We need to acknowledge our responsibility in creating some of this stuff. Now, the other day, we hopefully just put to rest this notion that God causes natural disasters in order to punish people. It's just not the way it works. Natural disasters have no moral quality to them. After the flood, God said, I'm not going to do this anymore. And in the Beatitudes, Jesus says, love your enemy because God makes the rain fall on the just and the unjust alike. So Jesus separates this notion of moral agency from natural catastrophe. So, wildfires don't have a moral quality to them, except we need to say things worse. We need to confess our sin and acknowledge what we've learned about human agency by our hubris in thinking we could suppress all wildfire. We've made things way worse. That's sin. Every time we try to put ourselves in the position of God, we run into problems, and this is just another lesson in that. Finally, we need to decenter ourselves. Although this is a funny way to put it. It could be that just normal creation is that we are not the center of creation. This is theologically quite a lively conversation because, of course, we are made in the image of God, human beings, and we are the only part of creation that's made in the image of God. In Genesis 2, God breathes God's spirit into Adam, into the human creature. So we do stand in a unique position in creation. The hairs of our heads are numbered. I mean, we don't want to get rid of that or let go of that. We are beloved in the Lord. And yet, I want to say we've got to find a way to step back from seeing ourselves at the very center of creation. We're not what it's all about. And this is really, really hard. Sometimes we get in the way of natural forces and we suffer. And we really have a hard time of grasping geologic time. I mean, time over thousands and ten thousands and hundreds of thousands of years. We just don't get it. And this is a problem, because if we did get it, we could see how earthquakes and volcanoes and fire have constructed our landscapes that we love, like these landscapes here. So here's the question with the decentering thing. Can we humans decenter ourselves from creation with love and generosity to the earth and to other species? Can we choose to decenter ourselves graciously? I mean, in one sense, we're already not there. If you look at Job and God's answer to Job out of the whirlwind, you know, this amazing struggle, and God basically says, well, I beg your pardon, were you there when I formed the earth and set it on its pillars? And God goes through this big boom, 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 and he talks about all the animals, completely independent of humankind being part of that scene. Humans are decentered in Job and in that answer of God out of the. And then Job's response is of faith. Oh, my God. It's an interesting move there. Can we do that? Can we choose to do that in our heads and our thinking about ourselves? Can we learn to act in ways that support the life of all species more equitably, even when it can result in human suffering? This is sort of the moral dimension of this theology. I have some friends who have a beautiful home on the wildland-urban interface outside of Missoula. And they're really wonderful people, and they're very aware of the moral dimensions, the ethical dimensions of their choice. And in these last fires in Missoula, 2003, they told the firefighters, if the fire comes this way and threatens our house, let it burn. Don't fight it. Don't protect our home. There are other things that you need to protect. Let it burn. That's an appropriate but breathtaking move to make here. It's really, I think, a paradigm of the cross. Unless a seed dies, it won't bear much fruit. Greater love has no one than this, than to give his or her life for his friend. And who is our friend if this is applied to us?
Your friends at an income level where if they made that sacrifice, they would be homeless the rest of their life?
No. That's an important point to make. Really important point. There were some homes that burned down in that fire, and at least one person I know of was really struggling after that. So, no, that's an important point to make. Let's just tuck that one away, the sense of the cross and the role of human sacrifice that I think just is part of this theology here. And let's move on to chaos theory, because I think chaos theory can help us if we can sort of try to get it.
Oh, good, and we'll probably have that.
Before we go there, any other comments, questions? Because I'm aware that I'm just spouting all sorts of stuff, and it's difficult in a way with this material to have much conversation. And I plan on having some good time at the end to have conversation. But before we jump into chaos theory, any other comments on what we've done?
I just keep going down to New Orleans. That's where my mind keeps going. And I think there's just such a deep ethical dilemma there. Yeah, you know, that the city was built in a place where it was going to, it was going to happen. So I think that there's a deep ethical, moral kind of, I think that difficulty going on here. For me, it's, I think we hold a lot of responsibility. The part about confessing our sin, you know, in where we choose to live and where we choose to build our homes. I think the ethical nature of this is very deep. Mm-hmm. Very deep.
And this is present in all of them. And we have to sort of ask ourselves, coming here in a dry season, do we deserve to live if a fire sweeps through, and do we deserve heroic efforts to save us because we chose to be here when a fire came? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's similar.
I mean, if that was our mantra, or whatever you want to say, I mean, if this was placed out front, how would that change how we live and where we chose to live? You know, what? I mean, I think there's all these questions out there. How would we function as a society?
Or maybe how would we see facing our demise if we accept it? Well, we're not immortal, and death's part of the plan. You know, then do we make peace with the idea that we might drown if we live in New Orleans, or burn if we live in the mountains as our death?
And then looking at the ethical issue on the individual level, though, it becomes a little different. I mean, if you, again, are a poor person in New Orleans, you might have been born there because your mm-hmm. parents were born there, and you've got this family and this tradition, and you can't afford to move, and you're there. You're in a really dangerous position, not by your own choice,
mm-hmm.
certainly not by your own hubris, but by the choices made long, long before you. And reflecting to a certain extent this human hubris that we can control nature. You know, we can keep this city from going underwater. But of course, when it was built, it wasn't beneath sea level. Building up the levees and the natural processes have helped New Orleans.
How do we coexist with the rest of creation?
And would we as human beings want to say, okay, Mississippi River Delta, we are going to stand back, and you can have your place again. And we'll rebuild New Orleans somewhere else. I don't think that's going to happen. But in a sense, that's where this stuff is leading me. The French Quarter still will never be the same. Are you ready to go to Cassie, or do you have some other comments that you want to make? Okay, in this conversation, I want to say up front that I'm not a chaos theorist. I'm really, really, really not a mathematician. And this stuff is really hard for me. I hope I understand it well enough that I can explain it well enough to you. But I know that there are those here who probably understand it better than I do. And if you have another example to give or another way of saying it, please, please, please do. Okay? I think chaos theory can help us move here theologically. And I'm going to be doing a little bit of reading from other resources here, because it's better than me trying to paraphrase it. Here's a little chaos theory for dummies. Originally, chaos theory was a mathematical construct discovered because computers came on the scene, and we can now, with the help of computers, do really complex calculations with huge amounts of data in a short amount of time that we could never do before. But the theory has not been stuck in mathematics. It has been applied to natural systems and even human systems like economics. So, three main points to chaos theory, as I understand it. First of all, we need to understand that not all systems are chaotic. But those that are show what's called an extreme sensitivity to initial conditions. So that if you change something in a teeny-weeny-weeny way at the start, let's say at the start of a mathematical equation, which is how it was going, if you change just a little, like in the thousands or ten thousands point after the decimal, you can produce a huge change on the other end that you would not be able to predict. So little teeny changes at the beginning of a chaotic event can result in huge, unpredictable changes on the other end. The butterfly effect comes out of this notion. You've heard this, the butterfly flapping his wings in Hong Kong can, through the interplay of winds and weather and all these sort of random things that it encounters on the way, trigger a hurricane off the coast of Florida. Now, this thing is still hard for me to believe, quite frankly. I think, and they think Christianity is hard to have faith in. It sounds so wacko. But, okay, I'm trying to have this on a matter of faith. Second point in chaos theory, what looks random and totally disordered in the short view demonstrates remarkable and even beautiful patterns in the long view. But again, these patterns cannot be predicted because a little teeny-weeny change on the front end that we can't even measure all the time or anticipate will change how it turns out. People who know math refer here to fractals, these lovely, intricate patterns that repeat themselves and repeat themselves. And I'm just going to try to get a good illustration of a fractal. Came across a few in this book, Gödel, Escher, Bach, which predates much talk about chaos theory per se, but it's talking about it using other words. And here are just a couple of mathematical graphs that I'll pass around that I think illustrate what we're talking about in chaos theory pretty well. You input these figures. There's something a little bit unexpected in the formula, and you get these incredibly beautiful and intricate and repeating graphs and designs. I'll just pass this around and you can look at it. There's also a very interesting little piece of art in here by M.C. Escher that he called Order and Chaos. And if you look at things more visually and artistically, you might want to go here. They're the first and last bookmarks. Okay, chaos theory people, is that adequate? What would you add? I have a couple illustrations I'll talk about, but what would you add? Yeah?
Well, I have a question. How is chaos theory different from complexity theory? Are they sort of both sides of the same coin?
Well, I'll talk about complexity theory in a second. My understanding is that complexity theory is sort of one step before chaos. It's that edge between, it's on the edge of chaos. That edge between order and chaos is complexity. But we're going to end up there, so hang on. Let me give you the two illustrations that seem to make sense to me. The weather is one of the first examples of a chaotic system. In order to make long-term weather forecasts, it would be necessary to take an infinite number of measurements, which would be impossible to do. You can't just keep measuring things forever. Also, because the atmosphere is chaotic itself, tiny uncertainties would eventually overwhelm any calculations and defeat the accuracy of the forecast. The presence of chaotic systems in nature seems to place a limit on our ability to apply the old physical laws to predict motions with any degree of certainty. So in other words, the old physics, the old laws of cause and effect, really don't work anymore. And that's this big revolution. Another example, ant trails. When you look at ants in nature, and you look at individual ants, or just a couple, it looks like what they're doing is totally random. There's no order to it. But you get a critical mass of ants together, and you do need a certain number of ants to see this. Then, together, they make ant trails, and they're all sort of rolling in the same direction. They make these beautifully intricate ant trails. So what looks random in the short view, in the big view, is really rather beautifully ordered. Do you guys have any other examples of chaos theory that help you understand it? Carol, you know, you've done some.
One of the things that I remember from just a little bit that I've learned is the example of cruciform vegetables, like cauliflower and broccoli, how actually, I mean, they have these patterns, but they're really, initially they're random patterns, but this order develops beyond that. And it's almost that the chaos is an intermediate step between the beginning and the end, because when a formula, a mathematical formula, is played out that demonstrates this with the initial small variable, it takes on, and they've done this with computers. The reason that Gudula Escherbach has done this is it was before they had computers that could play these formulas out to the degree that they can now. They develop these beautiful patterns. And when you start looking at it, it's like the same pattern over and over again. It's the same pattern on a small edge, on a small bit, and then on a larger sense, and on a larger and larger and larger sense. So that this pattern, which some people have called the eye of God, because it actually resembles something discernible that's almost there on an intuitive level, there's a good possibility that this is also the structure of the universe. So it is patterned, but between here and there, it's very chaotic.
Yeah.
And I don't know, is that...
No, that's helpful. I mean,
they've got these beautiful things when they add color to it, with these beautiful patterns.
It's helpful to think of the chaotic piece being in the middle from the beginning, and then chaos, randomness, wackiness, and then this gorgeous.
Right. Well, when you take a little bit, it's chaotic. Yeah.
Right.
But when you take the whole pattern, it's rather ordered.
Right. Thanks, Carol.
We live between this and this. That's where we live.
Right. And that's the problem. Pete, were you thinking of something? You're just playing with your pencil?
Yeah.
So, thanks, Carol. That's helpful. Anybody else have any other example they want to give us? So here's the thing. Here's where I want to go with this. Chaos theory has been applied to huge numbers of things. The study of disease outbreaks, population growth, war, stock market, in addition to these mathematical formula and patterns. Now, the suggestion, and I think, Carol, you were certainly going there too, is that the principles of chaos might lie beneath creation, all of creation. And then, instead of creation being defined by order and the comforting law of cause and effect and predictability, creation is really defined by unpredictability and seemingly random occurrences. These occurrences tend towards order in the long run, and even beautiful order. In the big picture, then, over geologic time, or in the bigger picture, over complex systems running themselves out, creation follows a pattern. Our problem as humans is that the patterns are just too big for us to see, or too far away, or we just can't see them. We do have a hard time thinking like a mountain. In fact, we can't. So, here's the theological piece. We have to trust that the patterns are there. We have to have faith that what looks like chaos to us has a meaningful pattern in the long run. We might call that God's design for creation. Okay, let's stop here for a second. Comments?
Something that's antithetical to the journey of embracing chaos is to say, oh, it's just the way we see it, and it's not chaotic, because God's just more complex than we have ever been able to allow, so we'll call it chaos, but we'll race ahead to a faith that says, oh, he's just a big artist. We didn't realize how big he paints. You know, it's sort of, can't zoom ahead to that. It's like, for me, I have to live with the idea that maybe God is somehow, and my human brain sort of stops here, but somehow both chaos and order. And it never disentangles itself and comes out, the winner is order. But that chaos and order are the definition of God. And we have to rest uneasily with that. Mm-hmm.
So to think of this as God's design is, in a way, too easy. It's rushing.
Well, design just negates chaos.
Yeah.
Except for fractals turn out to have a design. So, but I'm afraid that that's the easy, comfortable place we raced ahead to when we started grappling with the wing of the butterfly or the randomness. Mm-hmm. Is we, oh look, if you blow it up big enough or you play with it enough, a pattern emerges. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's the end of the story either, the pattern that emerged.
Because then maybe that pattern will break down into a chaotic thing again.
I think so. Yeah. I bet so.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, and don't you think we need that too? I mean, don't you hate it when your beloved says, I knew you were going to say that. It's like, you want to have a certain uniqueness or unpredictability to life. It's part of what feels like life.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, I think that's true, because even in chaos theory, that beautiful pattern that emerges is part of another chaotic theory, another chaotic pattern that produces another beautiful, or another chaotic system that produces another beautiful pattern that is part of another chaotic system that produces another beautiful pattern. You know, so there's not a lot of comfort in that, because our lives are a very small part of that, even if we look at the whole.
Yeah.
You know.
Even if we could see it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the only thing that's, you know, really what it boils down for me is again that the only kind of a theological position I can see is one in which God takes on humanity, takes on flesh. Mm-hmm. Because other than that, it's not comforting. I mean, we have comfort in art, I think, because we recognize something that is true, or it feeds us in a way, or it touches us in a way, but it doesn't solve a problem.
Right, right.
It only gives us recognition. And so that's, I mean, essentially that's why I find the only face of God that makes sense to me in Jesus.
Yeah.
In a God that takes on flesh and
and enters into the chaos.
With me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to make a claim for both. And I think you're doing this, Rita, the sense that it's not just this chaos and the suffering. I mean, Christ also enters into the beauty of humanity, as fragile as that is. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking this morning of all the ways that Book of Leviticus, all those little rules on how to live together, are so similar to all the little signs we have posted around Holden about how to sort your Kleenex and how to scrape your dishes and just sort of what it requires for a group to live together and and be in community, but I have also thought about the extreme opposite of so many of Jesus' messages being, when your brother sins against you, forgiven 70
yeah.
times, things that would seem to acknowledge that none of those rules and regulations really work, and in the end you just have to have mercy and forgive each other. And I can kind of see those two themes running throughout Scripture and kind of being parallel to what you're mm-hmm. saying mm-hmm. about there being patterns that we find comfort in, mm-hmm. but the truth being that there's a lot of chaos, and that it's kind of comforting to just acknowledge the truth of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we can't get out of the grieving part of this or the complicity part of this. I mean, we just can't in this. But it's helpful. It's helpful to sort of pull me back from the notion of, ooh, in the end there's this lovely pattern. But it's not in the end it's a lovely pattern. It's just part of the dynamic, this ongoing dynamic. It's sort of like a version of that old theology of, oh, life is just nothing but this veil of tears, but by and by in the sky we're going to end up in heaven and it'll be all sweet in the end. I don't want that. Yeah, we don't want to do that. That's not real helpful. Let's go on to a little talk about complexity and a little conversation with Gordon Kaufman, and then we'll be done and we'll have some more time to talk. Complexity theory. You know, this chair is lined up in just the wrong spot because you guys all end up there. There. Now I can see you. Complexity is what happens on the edge of chaos. And it's where most creativity happens. So just think about it in everyday life. When and where are you most creative? Think about the creative power of dreams and that sort of energy. I always think about Robert Louis Stevenson writing in the middle of the night. At a certain time of the night, he'd wake up and he just had these ideas that came to him in this time. And he was half awake and he wrote. Maybe that's how you can finish your book in the middle of the night. But when are you most creative? I think it's a bit, for me, it's a bit when I'm a little off-center. When are we most open to the Spirit of God? You know, I think it's pretty common to be open to the Spirit on either side of grief, transition, change, surprise. But not too far on the other side when we get so settled that we get really comfy. And not in the middle of grief where life is just too chaotic to be creative. It takes too much energy to just be there. But creativity on the edge of chaos. And there is where our common assumptions are tweaked just enough to open up new ways of thinking and new possibilities, new behaviors, new ways of believing. So here I think is where we hit theological pay dirt. In another way. Gordon Kaufman is a retired professor of systematic theology at Harvard Divinity School. And this too is in the bookstore. If you like philosophical theology, this is for you. It's a tough read, but it's pretty fascinating. This isn't the main point that I want to emphasize, but Kaufman basically says that God is best understood as creativity itself. Kaufman wants to de-anthropomorphize God, not talk about God in personal or human-like metaphors, but in terms of creativity itself. And then also he takes humans out of the center of creation as well. He really wants to emphasize the ultimate mysteriousness of God. And reading through this book, I thought, oh, that's one thing I surely get. This is a whole mystery to me. But here's the main point that I think can be really fruitful for us. At least it got me pretty excited. Here, Kaufman is quoting from Mark Taylor in his recent book, The Moment of Complexity, Emerging Network Culture, published in 2001. According to complexity theorists, all significant change takes place between too much and too little order. When there's too much order, systems are frozen and cannot change. When there's too little order, systems disintegrate and can no longer function. According to Ilya Prigogine, he's an Italian mathematician, I think. Disorder does not merely destroy order, structure, and organization, but is also a condition of their formation and transformation. New dynamic states emerge in conditions far from equilibrium. Complex adaptive systems always emerge at the edge of chaos and are in a state of continual evolution. Creativity is here presented as somehow emerging between the order and the disorder found in every system or structure. They're talking about every system or structure here with this creativity. Taylor sums up, life continues only as long as things are out of balance. So much for all of our work on balancing our lives. I mean, I read this and I had to laugh out loud. It's always been a big challenge for me. So here's another guy, Per Bach, talking about complex natural systems. Think here about a forest. Complex behavior in nature reflects the tendency of large systems with many components to evolve into a poised critical state, way out of balance, where minor disturbances may lead to events called avalanches of all sizes, catastrophic events rather than a smooth, gradual path. The evolution of this way, this very delicate state, occurs without design. Other people have pointed out this phenomenon that in evolutionary terms, you can have an organism looking the same for thousands and thousands of years, and then all of a sudden, boom, it makes an evolutionary leap, has this avalanche change. Comments on that? And then I have a little theological conclusion from Kaufman, too. See, so, you're saying creativity lives in this state of being out of balance. And so being out of balance is not a bad thing. We probably couldn't live there all the time, but it's an essential thing if we're going to be living in new ways and learning to adapt to the needs of the earth.
Well, it's kind of like saying necessity is the mother of invention, that when you have a problem, that's when you have to come up with some new way of doing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sort of the old way of saying that. I think what this leads me to, at least, is a different way of then valuing the out-of-balance state. Instead of out-of-balance state being something to avoid or work against or try to get back in balance, might I be able to live a little more lightly in that out-of-balance state and appreciate it? And appreciate where God is in it with me.
Well, I'm thinking about the Eastern Forest and 30 years ago, the firs died, and now then 10 years ago the pines died, and now the hemlocks are starting to die. And I'm thinking, well, we're supposed to celebrate this, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's kind of hard to celebrate the loss of something that's really beautiful, right?
It raises another question that totally probably blows away this whole thing. If that's the result of global warming.
It's the result of pollution, and the trees are stressed. Right. That's the pollution.
Right. But if we, you know, if the global warming thing is happening to the whole Earth, which is unprecedented in our history, does any of this make sense at all?
It's driving everything out of balance.
Well, it makes sense in that giant way of maybe Earth's time is over, and another planet and another solar system is next for consciousness. Or, I mean, you have to accept those possibilities because we are part of creation and we have done our thing, which is a drive toward order and ease. So we've dug into the mountains and we've mined and we've burned oil and we've had warm lives and zoomed around, and if we can't decide to pull back from that, then we will cease to, this earth will cease to have that kind of life. But that doesn't mean that all of God isn't true, or that God won't keep expressing God's self in creation. It's a horrible possibility, but pretty real.
Talk about grief and complicity. Well, let me finish up with Kaufman, and then we can sort of go wherever you want to go with this. Kaufman then now addresses the question of the God of love in all this, which has been a little absent in this whole business of big chaotic systems. From at least the time of Moses, God has been regarded as the source and ground of human morality, and for Christians, that morality has been epitomized in the divine love, agape. Indeed, it was possible for the early Christians to go so far as to say flatly that God is love. So then Kaufman asks the question, can such claims as these be in any way accommodated to the idea of God as the creativity in and through which our vast impersonal universe has come into being? A creativity that often brings forth new realities through massive violent destruction of other realities already in place. Exploding stars, cosmic black holes that swallow up everything in their vicinity. On planet Earth, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, floods, and I would add fire. Nature red in tooth and claw. This violence, it would seem, is deeply connected with the creativity manifest in the world. And if it suggests any kind of morality at all, many would say it is a morality of naked power. Is not this sort of creativity, this sort of God of violent power, at the antipodes of everything central to Christian faith? So he asks the question, and he answers it, no. Because, I won't read this part, but his argument is that in the trajectory of evolution, God has brought our trajectory in the place where we are moral agents, that we are capable of making informed moral choices that act non-violently and in the spirit of the love of God that we know in Christ. So he says, no, that's not sort of the trajectory of the universe, because the humans are here able to lift up nonviolent love. I'm not sure that's really comforting in the end to me. Maybe that's the place in our human system, though, where that we can strive for. Maybe it's the only place we can strive for. Here's his conclusion. There will be those who say that in this theology, God has really disappeared in the mists of mystery, and that true faith in God is thus also gone. To that I reply, true faith in God is not living with the conviction that everything is going to be okay in the end, because we know that our Heavenly Father is taking care of us. It's not true faith, he says. It is rather acknowledging and accepting the ultimate mystery of things, and precisely in face of that mystery, going out like Abraham, not really knowing where we're going, but nevertheless moving forward creatively and with confidence. Confidence in the serendipitous creativity that has brought our trajectory and us into being, has continued to sustain the human project within the web of life that surrounds and nurtures us, and has given us a measure of hope for that project here on planet Earth. Since we now see that we are to love and give ourselves and our lives not only to our human neighbors and enemies, but also to the wider orders of life in which we find ourselves, this perspective deepens and widens the radicality of the Christian ethic, and thus the radicality of the Christian faith. So that's where Kaufman ends up. And so I want to add one more thing to this little equation here. force, as chaos is to creation, as death is to life. And seen through a Christian lens, I mean, this has been radically reinterpreted in the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. And it seems that that same pattern holds true all the way. Chaos is radically reinterpreted. Wildfire has been radically reinterpreted. So that we end up in life, not nice, clean, tidy life, but messy, chaotic, challenging life. Hallelujah. Okay, so that's what I've got. What do you have? Comments, questions,
responses?
So it seems like, right now it seems like it's pretty clear that there's not a perfect balance around, and that maybe that's not a bad place to be. Maybe it's sort of this, you know, that's our path and that's the way of things, and we can take a sort of comfort in that, in the mystery to come. And there's that guy who was here before saying there's nothing we could do to hurt our environmental surroundings. And he said that earlier, talking about global warming. And it's just interesting to think about, because, you know, if we're out of balance, and maybe that's our path, and, you know, we're trying, a lot of people are trying to bring it back into balance, and it's just some interesting trains of thought going around here.
I think this thing would lead us, I mean, if our friend was here and we were in conversation with him, that our current out of balanceness might lead us to a new thing. Mm-hmm. That would help the earth. That would be for the sake of life.
The couple of things that for me, I think I put another equation of sacrifice with a line and then blessing as part of how we've grappled. And Christ, for me, the example, the upside downness of the truth that by giving up, by dying, by being passive, by living a short life, by being crucified unjustly, all the things that just raise up this indignation in us when an innocent dies. Especially when an innocent dies by choice, it just feels so deeply upside down. And the example of Christ is the ultimate example of God, this amazing, wild, creative, everything becoming vulnerable and allowing death on a cross. So I pair that with my own struggles to make little tiny sacrifices that don't even approach death on a cross. And then I take comfort in that butterfly wing, because I think, okay, I cannot at this stage of my evolution spiritually crawl on a cross and die. I'm not even very good at being careful how I shop. And I use too much fuel and I'm a big pig. But once in a while I make some effort toward environmental or human love. And I think, okay, God, take this little butterfly wing of my effort and put it in the equation as best you can, and I'll keep trying.
Yeah, thanks, Rita. I find that very hopeful, very, very hopeful. The butterfly effect of love and community, responsible action. Any Any other comments? We're just a little past time. I'll hear the bell here pretty soon. Well, thank you very much for coming and doing the heavy lifting together today.
Now we get to go be creative, right?
Yeah, right. Oh, now we get to go eat.
No. I mean, prepare our thing for tomorrow.
Oh, that's right. Oh, thank you, Rita. Yeah. For those of you guys who are new today, tomorrow's time at 3:45 is take all of these thoughts and bring a poem, a song. Even if there's a song in the LBW that you say, oh my goodness, this is what it's talking about, bring that.
Can we build a fire?
I don't think we can build a fire. Too bad, we could have danced around a fire. So tomorrow at 3:45, it's sort of meeting together and see what we might bring for conversation and celebration and stuff to that time. We might do it at the Ark, or thank you.
Thanks, Judy.
Yeah,